Okay, today we welcome Jerry Murphy. Ooh, I just set myself on fire there. Jerry is speaking on the topic of coming home to the true and higher self. He's a reflection on what it means to be a truly human and individuated being in the world. Sorry about that, Jerry. I was lighting myself on fire while I was introducing you. Welcome, Jerry.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. I actually was laughing to myself a little earlier, not laughing, but, you know, because I work in languages, I teach British English to business professionals around the world, but we're always running up against words and expressions and idioms that differ between US and British English. So I was just thinking when you were talking about dropping a stone, if you drop a stone in Ireland, you're losing weight. So because we measure weight in, I don't know, pounds and stones and what have you. But I didn't want to interject with that. Anyway, yeah, so thank you, Amy, for your introduction. So let me just start with the idea that came to me for giving my presentation today. And it happened in 4 years ago when I was running a small retreat center in Florida. I was running a one-day program. And we had gathered as a group of about 8 or 10 people, and we were just beginning the program where everyone kind of introduces themselves. You know, you say who you are, where you've come from, maybe the reason that you're joining the group for the retreat and what you hope to get out of it. So this particular morning, we were in the middle of introducing ourselves as a group, and a kind of a middle-aged guy sort of swaggered in, and I looked kind of the hippy-dippy kind of look about him, but, you know, he was gentle and calm, and he sat down in the middle of the floor. He didn't take a seat, kind of cross-legged. And so I said, you know, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining the group. We're just introducing ourselves. You know, would you mind maybe introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about your reason for coming to the program? And he kind of, in an abrupt way, said, there is no me. There is no self. That's completely a fabrication or an illusion. So there is no me or self to introduce. So you may as well go to the next person. So he kind of stunned me because I wasn't expecting that. But it was a kind of an awkward, disconcerting moment. And he refused to introduce himself. And I had to go to the next person. Anyway, I just share that because it sparked my idea for this morning. Because intellectually, I kind of understood where he was coming from. Because I remember a few years ago when I was running Jubilee House Retreat Center, I actually joined a meditation group at Elder Spirit. So this would have been 2010 or 2011. And it was a group that was studying Buddhism. And Scott Boltwood, who's English professor at Emory and Henry, he was leading the group. So I don't know, Linda, if you remembered. I don't even remember if you were in that group or who was in the group. But we studied the four pillars of Buddhism, one of which is the doctrine of no self. So intellectually, when this guy didn't want to introduce himself, I kind of understood where he was coming from. I just felt he was, you know, taking himself too seriously. So anyway, that's the backdrop. So what I'm going to do right now is minimize this screen and pull up my Word document notes so I can longer see everybody. Sorry about that. I'm looking at my notes. And if you're not hearing me at any point, just interject and let me know. But I'm looking at my Word document notes for the next few minutes. Okay, so what I thought I would do today, because this whole idea of self, no self, higher self, whatever, it's commonly used in kind of spirituality parlance. And there often can be confusion around what do we mean by no self or true self or dark, you know, shadow self or higher self? What do we actually mean by that? So I thought I'd try and clear that up or at least offer my thoughts on it in a fairly brief manner. So my little roadmap is simply a brief little touching in on the Buddhism doctrine of no self, moving into Carl Jung's idea of the shadow self, or what Thomas Merton called the false self. From there, a quick little look at what we mean by true self, and then finally, what we might refer to as your higher self, and what possibly we mean by that. So the Buddhism doctrine of no self is one of the three main teachings, if you will, of Buddhism. You have anicca, which is impermanence, dukkha, suffering, and anatta, the doctrine of no self. So just a thumbnail definition, if you will, of what I understand Buddhism to mean by the doctrine of no self. So first of all, it's a teaching that it's not a negation of the existence of the phenomenal world. It's not saying the phenomenal world is some grand illusion. It's an argument against the intrinsic and independent existence of objects. So the contents of the world are all interdependently originated. It's basically what they're saying. The other term they use for that is what they call interdependent co-arising. Nothing or no one exists in and of themselves. And that's a fairly commonly accepted understanding. I mean, I only exist because my parents brought me into this world. I only exist because I can breathe the oxygen and avail of the natural resources of the earth and go to the supermarket. And there's a million people involved in why I exist or any of us exist. And that's their doctrine of interdependent co-arising. So everything interdependently arises from the web of the cosmos. Now, our egoic self, or the I, is what they would say a combination of frequency, or the word they use is skandhas, or aggregates. So the five aggregates that Buddhism would say kind of constitutes what we call the self are form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. So if we try to look for a singular entity that we call the self, we will find these five skandhas. And upon deeper introspection, they would consider that to be illusory. That, you know, we only exist because of the emergence of these five properties or these five aggregates. But we ascribe permanence to them, calling them collectively a self. And that's the illusion that the Buddhism doctrine would kind of contend. So, for example, our personalities are largely built upon our habitual reactions to situations. Like at a primal level, we tend to react with craving to pleasant sensations and aversion to unpleasant sensations. So who we are or think we are is always fluid. It's never a permanent fixed entity. And that's in my understanding, very basic understanding of the Buddhism doctrine of no self. Okay, let's move into what Carl Jung had to say about the shadow self. And I'm not a psychology major or anything even remotely to that, but I do remember stumbling upon it here and there. So my understanding of the Carl Jung's concept of the shadow self, it's the shadow self or archetype that is either an unconscious aspect of the personality that the conscious ego does not identify in itself, or it's the entirety of the unconscious. Everything of which a person is not fully conscious. In short, the shadow is the unknown side of the human psyche or personality. It can include really everything outside the light of consciousness, and it may be positive or negative. But because we tend to reject or remain ignorant of the least desirable aspects of our personality, the shadow self tends to largely be negative. In Carl Jung's own words, it's the unknown dark side of the personality. It's also instinctive and irrational. And it's the place, if you will, from which the impulse to reject our own inferior sense of self onto others emerges. So that's very, very briefly a thumbnail definition or my understanding of Carl Jung's shadow self. Now, in tandem with that, I would like to refer to what Thomas Merton had to say about what he coined as the false self. Now, Thomas Merton, you may not know or be familiar with his work. He was a Trappist monk back in the 60s. He spent most of his life at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky. He's originally from France, but moved at a very young age to the United States. So he became a Catholic Cistercian, or more commonly known as a Trappist monk. But he made a name for himself as a writer, as a mystic, as a peace and justice, nonviolence activist in the 60s. And in fact, he was on a trip to Thailand in the late 60s on a kind of a peace activism or kind of a interreligious program of some kind. And he died in a freak electrical accident. But he's written a number of books, which those who particularly profess some kind of Christian spirituality often refer to. He was kind of considered a leading progressive thinker back in the 60s. So he coined the term false self, very similar in many ways to Carl Jung's shadow self. So what I want to do here is refer to a couple of passages from one or two of his books. Now, being a writer in the 60s, just to warn you, if you will, you know, he would have used the male pronoun referring to God, and would have used God as well in his theology and in his thinking. So I hope that doesn't offend anyone. He also would use the term sin. Now, he does kind of elaborate on what he means by sin, but the term sin, God, and using the male pronoun would have been fairly commonplace back in the 60s. So no offense intended when I, you know, reference him in these little passages. Okay, let me start with what he would say, what he means by the false self. And this is taken from one of his books titled New Seeds of Contemplation. So these are Merton's words, not mine. Every one of us is shadowed by an illusory person, a false self. This is the man I want myself to be, but who cannot exist because God does not know anything about him. And to be unknown of God is altogether too much privacy. My false and private self is the one who wants to exist outside the reach of God's will and God's love, outside of reality and outside of life. And such a self cannot help but be an illusion. If we are not very good at recognizing illusions, we are not very good at recognizing illusions, least of all is the ones we cherish about ourselves, the ones we are born with and which feed the roots of sin. For most of the people in the world, there is no greater subjective reality than this false self of theirs, which cannot exist. A life devoted to the cult of this shadow is what is called a life of sin. Okay, those are Merton's thoughts. My own interpretation of that is basically this, that the false self, sensing its fundamental unreality, begins to clothe itself in myths and symbols of power. And since it intuits that it is but a shadow, that it is nothing, it begins to convince itself that it is what it does. Hence, the more it does, achieves, and experiences, the more real it becomes. And again, just to quote a little bit more from Thomas Merton, all sin starts from the assumption that my false self, the self that exists only in my own egocentric desires, is the fundamental reality of life to which everything else in the universe is ordered. Thus, I use up my life in the desire for pleasures and the thirst for experiences, for power, honor, knowledge, and love, to clothe this false self and construct its nothingness into something objectively real. And I wind experiences around myself and cover myself with pleasures and glory like bandages in order to make myself perceptible to myself and to the world. And if I were as if I were an invisible body that could only become visible when something visible covered its surface. Okay, so that's basically just a snapshot of Thomas Merton's work on the false self. Now I'm going to move into basically a short little reflection on what he refers to as the true self and my interpretation and understanding of that. So he had this, it was kind of like a mystical epiphany conversion experience one afternoon when he was at the corner of 4th and Walnut in Louisville, Kentucky, watching people walk by, going about their business. He had some moment of personal epiphany and conversion, and he wrote about it. And it's basically his reflection on what he understands as the true self. It's a very, very beautiful and often quoted passage from, which book was it? Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. This is a quote from that book on his reflection on the true self. At the center of our being is a point of nothingness, which is untouched by sin and illusion, a point of pure truth, a point or spark which belongs entirely to God, which is never at our disposal, from which God disposes of our lives, which is inaccessible to the fantasies of our own mind or the brutalities of our own will. This little point of nothingness and of absolute poverty is the pure glory of God in us. It is, so to speak, God's name written in us as our poverty, as our indigence, as our dependence, as our birthright. It is like a pure diamond blazing with the invisible light of heaven. It is in everybody. And if we could see it, we would see these billions of points of light coming together in the face and blaze of a sun that would make all the darkness and cruelty of life vanish completely. I have no program for this scene. It is only given. But the gate of heaven is everywhere. So that was taken from Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. So my simple little interpretation of that is that most people spend their entire lives living up to the mental self-images of who they think they are, instead of living, if you will, in the primal I that is already good in God's eyes, or source of being, divine consciousness, universal consciousness, whatever you might want to refer to as God. So thinking creates the separate self, the ego self, the insecure self. The God-given contemplative mind, on the other hand, recognizes divinity and the God self within, the Christ self, the Buddha self, the Krishna consciousness self, call it what you will. So that, you know, the divine contemplative mind recognizes and knows this. This is the true self of abundance and deep inner security. But sadly, most of the times, it's either distracted or obscured or misplaced. So on that, I also want to just quote you a short passage from my own book, where in one of my chapters, I think it's the chapter Send in the Clowns, I do play around with this idea of self and public persona. And this is what I said in this particular chapter. So in Buddhism, there is a term, turiyatita. It means the participant observer, the one who doesn't identify with his physical body or public persona, but still totally honors the experience / mission of incarnation. I believe that this is the goal those of us who are overly consumed with our professional identity need to aspire to. What we do is overrated. It is who we are in the doing of what we do that is pivotal to our spiritual growth. Therefore, it matters not whether we are a national celeb, president, or a benighted soul eking out a living in the barrios. What matters is the disposition of awareness we bring to every experience we create. Is it a disposition of presence, kindness, reverence, and compassion? Or is it one of gratuitous self-aggrandizement? In the final analysis, it will not be our profession, fame, money, or social standing that we will be remembered for, but the moral and spiritual legacy we leave behind. Okay, let me sit you into another little section here where I'm just kind of supporting what I previously said on the true self. And that's just simply to say that virtually all the great spiritual traditions of the world share the conviction that humanity is the victim of what you might call a tragic case of mistaken identity. There is, if you will, a small self and a self with a capital S. And our fatal mistake lies in confusing the two. The egoic self is in virtually every spiritual tradition immediately dispatched to the realm of the illusory, or at best, transitory. It is the imposter who claims to be the whole. Now, the imposter can become a good servant, but generally it is a dangerous master. Awakening is a matter of piercing through the charade of the smaller self to develop a stable connection with the greater or higher self, becoming intimate with our spiritual identity, the sense of selfhood carried in our spiritual awareness. Okay, and now I am going to kind of gently come to a closure here by just reflecting very briefly on the term the higher self, or in some spiritual texts you'll hear the term over soul. So it's they're interchangeable in some regards. So here is what I believe personally. Divine or universal consciousness energy permeates every atom, molecule, cell, electron, neutron, and dimension of what we call the universe. This divine or universal consciousness is benign, loving, and intelligent. In Hinduism, this is called Atman, the spiritual life principle of the universe, especially when regarded as inherent in the real self or the individual. In other words, a person's soul. So we are spiritual beings in a physical body having a human experience, the purpose of which is the evolution of our soul and spiritual consciousness. The higher self, or oversoul, if you will, this is the spiritual body of the human vessel, still remaining in full communion with the divine. The higher self, or oversoul, communicates through the intuitive mind, that directs the soul on the evolutionary path home to God, or our one source of being. And finally, as spiritual beings in physical bodies having human experiences, we are living in what you might call a great school of duality. What do I mean by a school of duality? Love and hatred, darkness and light, fear and ignorance, and the ultimate illusion, separation. Separation from what? From our true and higher self, separation from one another, separation from the planet, and separation from our one source of being. We're very, in terms of collective human consciousness, very polarized, very fragmented, infused with a lot of fear, ignorance, and darkness. And that's what's illusory and irrational, but it is what we are experiencing currently very much, you know, here in the United States. Okay, so I'm just going to share with you a little, it's a short poetic piece to conclude my presentation. It's from William Wordsworth, who I studied many, many years ago when studying Romantic period in English literature. So this is quite a long poem, so I'm not going to read it all. It's Tintern Abbey, or I think the long title was a few lines, well, I forget what the long title, written a few miles from whatever, Tintern Abbey. It had a longer title, but I have Tintern Abbey here. And I'm going to read for you the second verse, because I felt this, when I was looking at this last night, that it kind of very beautifully and poetically expressed the quest to come home to the true and the higher self while still being in engagement with the lived human experience that we all have. So the second stanza from Tintern Abbey by William Wordsworth. These beauteous forms, through a long absence, have not been to me as is a landscape to a blind man's eye. But oft, in lonely rooms, amid the din of towns and cities, I have owed to them, in hours of weariness, sensations sweet, felt in the blood and felt along the heart, and passing even into my purer mind with tranquil restoration. Feelings too of unremembered pleasure, such perhaps as have no slight or trivial influence on that best portion of a good man's life. His littleness, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Nor less, I trust, to them I have owed another gift of aspect more sublime. That blessed mood in which the burden of the mystery, in which the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened. That serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on. Until the breath of this corporeal frame, and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul. While with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things. All right, that is my little spiel for this morning. So I will mute out here and people can reflect or comment.
If you'll just raise your hand. Thank you, Jerry. If you will raise your hand, we can take turns speaking and asking Jerry questions. Oh, Kim, yes.
I am thinking about the concept of the shadow self and how it's such a large part of who we are. And I'm wondering how to integrate that with the newer scientific evidence that our subconscious mind pretty much runs 95% of our thoughts and actions. So some people might think that we are largely just a shadow self.
And we've had these discussions, Kim, a number of times, and you're more expert than I am because of your work. But I think you're right. I think we are mostly influenced by darker human impulses that we're not most of the time probably aware of. The only way we can disarm that is to go into a state of meditation, either in a group or personally, or to do something that's meditative that disarms the darker and distracting impulses of the human psyche, where they're stilled. They need to be brought in a place of stillness, silence, and solitude. And then you're in a state of, hopefully, maybe call it a transcendent, possibly, state, depending on what type of, you know, Deepak Chopra has many, many beautiful guided meditations that I've used. I think you maybe have used as well, that can lead you into a state of stillness where your emotions are not overriding or distracting your state of your spiritual state of being. And I think that as human beings, that's probably as close as we can get to a place of not being influenced by the darker human impulses that we are when we're going about our daily business. I don't know of any other way. Maybe there are psychedelic legitimate, you know, drugs that people can take, plant medicine and what have you, that definitely have brought people to an altered state of consciousness. And I think if done in a setting that's ritualistic and supervised, I mean, I support people who do that and who've experienced healing and transformation and a whole new perspective on life as a result of going through that type of ritual. So that's a whole other quest. But it's a very relevant, you know, question and quest.
I think it's important too for people to know that when we, you know, referencing the shadow self and we talk about dark human impulses, that sometimes we're in a state of evolution while we're going through or experiencing those dark impulses. And I guess that could mean different things for different people, but right, some of that is simply purging or processing and evolving.
Right.
So the shadow self isn't really such a bad thing.
That's very true. It has to be a process of integration, recognizing, acknowledging, integrating the darker impulses while remaining on the spiritual evolution of your soul or journey, or call it what you will. Because otherwise we're going to be judging everyone left, right, and center for everything, you know, that's they say or do that seems to be dehumanizing or what have you. So I think you're right. It has to be a process of integration.
And acceptance, I think.
And acceptance. Absolutely. And awareness.
Go ahead, Harry.
I'm currently reading Jung's Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. And so I'm in the childhood section, and I encourage anyone who hasn't read that it's an extremely interesting book. I haven't read it in 40 or 50 years. Anyway, and this talk certainly got into that. In his childhood, he became very aware of being two selves. And he says at one point that most people never become really conscious of the second self. And to him, it was a wise old man, but it also included all of his intuition and all this. Anyway, Jerry, you've brought up a number of different images, and some of them make the shadow self negative and dangerous, and others honor it as part of where we need to go. It's all very confusing. And I'm hoping to give a talk on Jung's Memories, Dreams, and Reflections and add in any of my perspective, if I have any, from my life. The other thing that strikes me strongly, and I will listen to your talk again, it seems to me that the difference, the statement of the unexamined life isn't worth living, is in conflict with live in the moment. and the idea, I think, is this, that I read in between the lines of what you've told me today, is that what's really to be sought is a balance between the immediacy of personal experience, which much of the talk said was an illusion, dealing with the day-to-day reality and the mundane aspects and the search for success and happiness and pride and all those things. That's an illusion. And what's really important is that inner diamond of awareness of being part of God. And these two seem to be in conflict. And I think the temptation is to go with one or the other, when in fact, it seems to me that the only healthy way is to have both. And the only way to do that is this observer thing, to be very, very much in the moment, but also consciously knowing that you are really an observer of the self. Anyway, there's a lot in there to think about, and I really appreciate the different perspectives you gave us, and I find them sort of banging against each other and leaving me trying to reconcile them, which is, I'm sure, what you've had to try and do. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Harry. I mean, you are right. I don't mean to give a bad press to you know, human perception. I mean, human perception is flawed. You know, it is flawed, and we don't fully perceive or understand. I mean, even just in the natural world, everything that's happening interdimensionally, but especially in the human enterprise and in human relationships, we miss things. And I also just, to, you know, the idea of having a role in life. We all wear different hats and different roles and have different identities. And identities are important, you know, group identity, cultural identity. I mean, that's important on a human level. It's just not the whole story. And we can fall into over-identifying with our public persona and role and leave no room for nurturing the inner soulful evolution journey, if you will, or spirit. If we leave no room for that, then we're denying what I would consider our true self. But the public persona and images and identities we all wear are important, as long as we don't over-identify with them. Then we're lost in feeding and nurturing a false sense of who we truly are. And that's what leads to, I think, the kind of violence and division and arrogance and what have you that we are experiencing at the moment.
Jerry, this is Donna, I'm going to give a little plug for our Sangha group that meets on Sundays from 4:45 until 6. We start with a brief silent meditation, and then we do some readings. Right now we're doing the Dhammapada, and then we do discussion, and then we have a closing. Anybody is welcome to join that group, and we explore a lot of what Jerry has talked about today in his presentation. And it has been life-changing for me after the passing of my daughter, just life-changing. And the other thing is regarding the psychedelic treatment that will be coming, probably legally offered through, you know, several days of therapy led by a professional, will probably be 2022 when that will be offered. And I will go wherever I have to go to get that legal treatment. From what I've heard, it's just extraordinary, the experience. You just really reach the super level, the deep consciousness, and it just sounds so inviting to me. So thank you, Jerry, for that. It was beautiful. Thank you.
Welcome, Donna. Thank you for your comments.
I would like to thank you also for a very, very timely and thought-provoking talk this morning. It is so relevant to what we're all struggling with in so many levels right now. And I really appreciate your putting forth your thoughts. Thank you.
You're welcome.
see, Mike, your computer hand is up. Go ahead.
Jerry, in your concept of the true self or the higher self, is that still an individual identity or not?
I have a hard time.
Okay, I'll do it in text with the chat. Okay. My question is, Jerry, in your concept of the true self or the higher self, is that still an individual identity?
I think it's both an individual quest, Mike, as well as being a universal quest. You know, as I said somewhere along the way, that, you know, collective human consciousness is quite fragmented. So we're all searching in our own way and what have you for peace and stability and a sense of direction and purpose. So we're doing it individually, which I think is important, but it can't end there either. You have to, you know, the whole doctrine of independent, interdependent co-arising. We all have an accountability and a responsibility for the elevation of human consciousness as a whole. So I think it's something that you can come to a sense of global consciousness on your own. You feel connected with the wider world and with nature and animals and the universe, and that's an individual experience, but it's one that needs to be expressed and shared with the wider world and reflected in how you live your life, the witness of your life, your responsibility in terms of the environment, of stewardship, of accountability to the wider human community. So it is a collective thing. And so I would agree with you that, you know, it's easy just to go into a little insular world of privatizing your life and spirituality. And it's easy to do that, you know, obviously now in different phases of lockdown, we've become insular in many ways. So I feel it has to be both a personal ascension and a collective ascension in terms of the human species as a whole. At least that's how I perceive it. So I think we're getting there slowly.
Any other comments or questions for Jerry? Oh, Karen, yes.
I hesitate to make a comment because I find this topic so difficult to get my head around. But I'll just say what comes to me intuitively is that Merton's false self seems to me different from Jung's shadow self. If Merton was seeing the true self as that spot of emptiness and God, that seems to leave, I'm not saying I understand Merton, I've never read him, but it just seems to me that that would leave all the self that we recognize as the false self. And it seems like Jung is talking about the shadow self and the higher self would be the part of the self that we recognize, not that spot of emptiness and God. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that was just my intuitive reaction.
Sorry, Karen. Yeah, I was just checking. I think where Merton diverged a little in that kind of argument is that he sees the false self trying to externalize itself. In other words, it's your career, your job, your experiences, what you own, your social standing, what have you. That if we get lost in those roles or identities, then we've lost a sense of our inner core sense or true self. So it's getting lost in the external is what I think Merton was trying to say. Many of us tend to do that.
Okay, I get that then.
Yeah. So, okay.
is this false self? Is it versus the true self? Is this a playing out of our being expelled from the garden?
That's a good question. Expelled from the well, we do, you know, I did mention that, you know, we wrap his idea of wrapping yourself in a myth or in power or symbols. Yeah, you see, if expelled from the garden is expelled for what though? For original sin, whereas original sin really is separating yourself from a sense of your own divinity. You know, that's the original separation, that you feel separate from creator, creation, God, divine consciousness, call it what you will. You're not separate. You're a facet of, you know, bite size, if you will, of divine consciousness. You are, you know, the expression of the universe itself, of universal life and consciousness. So that's the, to me, original sin is the original illusion of separation. And we need to restore that. We're not separate from the creative impulse and the evolutionary impulse of life itself. We are the evolutionary impulse of life itself. So we are divine, and we have a divine inner calling and essence. So that's the original, I don't call it original sin, it's an original sense of being separated, when we're not, we never were, never will be. But if we get lost in that, then we're going to create our own reality externally and identify with that.
I just want to add one more quick comment that I see. I was raised a Catholic, so you can imagine where I'm coming from. But it seems to me that the weight of the spiritual community, if you want to call it that, is to downplay and belittle the day-to-day role in life. And I think that's a terrible mistake. I think to live your day-to-day life well, I mean, all the activists are out there doing things. They're not, anyway, I think one of the dangers of this is because we're so badly lost in our day-to-day lives that we're told, I'm told, I mishear that I should thereby ignore it. And I think that's a horrible message that I misinterpret from what's being told to me. And it's a danger. And I just want to bring that up, that yes, we do need to pursue the spiritual side, but to think that the other side is unimportant is to neglect your family, your life, your job, your career, your friends. So there's a very dangerous kind of shifting going on here. And I shouldn't point it at the people who are giving me the message. I should point it at me hearing the message the way I hear it. But I see it as a dangerous thing.
You're muted, Jerry.
Yeah. Sorry, Harry. I agree with you. I think I didn't mean to evoke that impression that the spiritual quest is a passive idea at all. And I agree with what you said earlier, the unexamined life is not worth living. We need to be critical thinkers in the world today. We need to be engaged, involved, accountable, responsible. We need to be critical thinkers. So that has to go hand in hand with contemplation. And, you know, there's a center in New Mexico. It's called the Center of for Contemplation and Action. It was founded by Richard Rohr, who's a Franciscan priest, and has written quite widely, and I think been sanctioned somewhat by the Vatican because he's quite a radical thinker. But the whole idea of the center for contemplation and action is that you do both, that you come home to your sense of your truer self, your higher self, your being contemplative, you know, paying attention contemplatively to the world. And then through your critical thinking and judgment, you act. So you become an agent of change. But that comes from the wellspring of your spiritual awareness and your spiritual growth. It has to come from a place that's centered and grounded. And so you need to be in that place in tandem with your critical thinking and your overt activism in the world. really you need, they have to go hand in hand, and it's vitally important that they do. So it's, you know, I've been asked the question, well, you know, you have these monastic nuns and monks and, you know, in their monasteries, what good are they doing to the world? What good, what use are they? Spend all day in prayer, meditation, what have you. And I think that's a misperception of the way of life that they're choosing to live. They see people who come to them for guidance and counsel, and the energy of their prayer and given where they are in terms of their spiritual consciousness is powerful. They are powerhouses of prayerful energy, and they're places of hospitality for people who come there for retreat or for counsel or guidance and teaching. So to kind of, you know, dismiss those who live a monastic life and are not apparently engaging with the world, I think is regrettable. So I think we need both. We need to encourage both.
I have one last thing to say. Maybe what wasn't apparent when you were giving your talk is that I kind of felt like there was a progression from, you know, Thomas Merton's original concept of the false or the shadow self. And when I hear you talk about day-to-day life, I'm thinking about modern life with all of our devices, everyone's on social media, using filters. And that is pretty much what people are focusing on. And that really is a false self. You know, we might see people with their perfect faces and perfect bodies living this, you know, beautiful life. And in reality, that's not what's happening at all. So I think maybe there, which I kind of felt that sort of progression in your talk where, you know, we kind of started out with Thomas Merton's concept, but you know, I think we've kind of evolved away from that a little bit. And when we're talking about the false self in day-to-day life, it's because we do have such a problem with people being addicted to their devices and really being consumed by them, or just this image that everyone wants to project about how they're really living. And there's really nothing spiritual about that most of the time. That's just my perception there.
Yeah, and it's a very real one, Kim, because that's, you know, I feel, you know, like your son and my kids, they've been out of school since March, and they're living very much in a virtual world of, for their schooling and for gaming and what have you. But we all do it. We're all on social media. I mean, I spend 25, 30 hours a week on my computer teaching learners from around the world. So, this is the environment and the reality that we live in. But we have to choose other ways to engage in the real world, which is the world of the environment, the world of nature, the world of human, truly human relationships, where people challenge each other to growth and bring healing and contribute something valuable to the community. Because, we're distracted. We're distracted so much of the time. It's our work. It's what we do. But there has to be that awareness.
Well, too, and I think maybe people aren't really thinking about, you know, you'll see families before the lockdowns even.
Right.
At a restaurant, right. And every single person is on their device.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, we all do it. We're compulsive. Where's the shift going to happen? Like what Harry mentioned earlier, the shift in human consciousness to something that's more integrated, healthier. I don't know what shape or form that will take, but right now we're in a very, very technologically advanced, fast-paced world where I don't think there's deep listening going on to the deep human needs that everyone has. And therefore, then we rush to violence and aggression and division without listening to and understanding who we are and who we are in relation to others. That can only come with awareness and the time that we need to give to that kind of awareness and shift in consciousness. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Jerry.
You're welcome.